Hello, everybody. My name is Ron Way, and this is part two of a conversation we started with three amazing scholars last week, Art Dewey, Roy Hoover, and Lane McGahey. I'm going to introduce them again because some of you didn't hear last week's introduction, so I would ask them to briefly just reintroduce themselves and tell us where they're from, where they teach, and I'll start with you, Roy.
I was a faculty member at Whitman College in Walla Walla, Washington for 27 years. I'm retired now as the Weyerhaeuser Professor of Biblical Literature and Professor of Religion from Whitman. I received my doctoral degree from Harvard University.
All right. And Art?
I also got my doctoral degree from Harvard, and I'm now in my 30th year at Xavier University in Cincinnati.
All right. Next,
Lane. Okay, Ron, I did my doctoral work at Vanderbilt University in Nashville. Then I taught for 12 years as a colleague of Bob Funk's at the University of Montana. And then from 1981 until 2007, I was the George Atkinson Professor of Religion and Ethics at Willamette University in Salem, Oregon.
Which is where the Jesus Seminar meets, ladies and gentlemen. The reason we're here this weekend together is because the Jesus Seminar, which is made up of maybe 70 New Testament scholars, they're held twice a year in the spring and the fall. We invite you to be members of our organization, which is called West Star, W-E-S-T-A-R. You can find them, Google Jesus Seminar or West Star. We invite you to join us. It's an amazing time where you get to rub shoulders with these gentlemen that are untouchable for most of the year. And they come together to discuss things with each other and to discuss with associates. I'm an associate. I'm not a scholar. I'm just a very interested associate. And they have meetings with us. We get to sit in. We listen to them argue with each other about fine points of the New Testament and the Bible. And it's an amazingly entertaining and exciting time for all of us. We're going to continue today with a session that we had earlier in the day here. We were talking about Paul. The book that we're talking about today is the brand new book. It's called The Authentic Letters of Paul, New Reading of Paul's Rhetoric and Meaning, and it's by Arthur Dewey, Roy Hoover, Lane McGahey, Daryl Schmidt. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention the contribution of Daryl, who passed away a few years ago. I wanted to mention his name. Now, I want to go into some of the controversial teachings, and I say controversial probably not for you, but for some in the church that don't approve of the way scholars look at some of these letters. In 1 Corinthians 7:10, Paul says, and I quote, "To the married, my instruction, not mine, but the Lord's, is that a wife should not divorce her husband." In verse 12, he says, quote, "We have no teaching from the Lord addressing those other situations," unquote. Here's my question. In Mark 10, Mark talks about divorce. You can't divorce, and that's Jesus is saying that to the people. And later it's copied by Matthew, that same basic admonition. I can't imagine. One of the most well-known quotes that we have is passed on orally, but if it was passed on orally, that's the only thing I find in Paul that he picked up from the Gospels. And it's almost like he heard that part of the Gospel from somebody. But nothing else. I don't recognize anything in his letters where he has the teachings that are also in the Gospel. Help me out here. Was he reading an early Gospel? And so he was passing that on, but that's the only thing he knew.
Sometimes in class, I suggest this. I use this giant green arrow, and I just have it coming down from the top, and it descends, and there's a big point, and I label that the oral tradition. And then I fill it in. I begin to fill it in with the words of Jesus. Again, this is part of the oral tradition. You get stories about the deeds of Jesus. Again, this is part of the oral tradition. Eventually, you get scrolls, but this is not early. The Q material can be dated anywhere from 45 to 65, and there might very well have been a development of the Q material. By Q material, I mean the material that you find in Matthew and Luke, but not in Mark. That Matthew and Luke both used a common source which is primarily sayings material, some of which goes back to the historical Jesus. So we have then a situation when Paul is writing in the late 40s, early 50s to around 60, he is part of that oral tradition. He's not part of a written tradition as such. And how much does he know of that oral tradition? We can only speculate. You picked up that one sentence, which might have come through perhaps in his contact with community in Syria. But beyond that, we don't have much evidence at all.
I'm trying to put myself back in Paul's shoes. Okay, I had some aha moment. Eventually, I get over to see the original disciples. And here's my it's like me meeting you guys. You guys are the closest thing I have to the Gospels to try to understand them. And Paul would have been meeting with Cephas sitting over here, and here's James and who knows, Andrew, John, whoever. And it wouldn't he be in sitting around saying, Mike, well, what did he say when you did that? Didn't he say anything about that? And I'd remember that. Why doesn't that show up in my writings? I don't understand that.
Well, it depends on what one considers important. One thing we find from Paul is that he considers his experience to be crucial. His experience. And in fact, his argument in his letters depends upon his listeners taking their experience very significantly. In fact, he reminds them to do that. So Paul never gives up on his experience, and he never gives up on his listeners' experience, which unfortunately in the history of the tradition has usually been lost. Paul's letters are seen as sort of communiques from on high, but in fact they're not. They're an attempt to persuade his audience, but the persuasion is based upon how the audience can relate from their experience to his argument. So it would seem that what Paul is saying, for example, in the Galatians, he says that he derives his authority not from human beings.
I know.
And that includes these people in the Jesus tradition.
So what you're saying, he didn't care much about this earthly Jesus. He didn't care about him much at all.
I don't think it's true he didn't care much about the historical Jesus. I think Paul sees himself as living in a new situation after the death and resurrection of Jesus.
That's right.
That changed the situation for Paul. So everything now was, how do we deal with this change in circumstance or in situation, since God has honored Jesus, exalted him, named him Lord? That changes things. The world has a new Lord now. Something has happened. This is after a momentous event. Now what do we do with that? That's where Paul is coming from. And so he's not looking back, remembering things Jesus said. He's asking, how do we now live after this momentous event and live as those who belong to a new Lord?
Yeah.
In that passage from 1 Corinthians, which you mentioned, chapter 7, that verse 12, we have no instruction from the Lord about this. He goes on to say, but as someone whom the Lord trusts, I offer you my advice. So he does go on to speak, in effect, on his own authority as somebody who has been appointed to a special mission by God, as somebody whom God trusts and therefore you can trust.
Right. It kind of blows me away, guys, when you think about this guy who didn't know Jesus, and he's pitted against the disciples or the original church followers that were there right with him, heard him, talked with him, walked with him, slept with him, urinated with him, argued with the locals with him. Come on, that's what happened, right? They were campers. They went from town to town.
They were itinerants.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the man that the other disciples knew. And here comes a Johnny come lately who says, I've had my own understanding and God's talking directly to me, and I don't need to consider these other things. I will tell you what I think because I've been appointed by God. I'm just speechless sometimes with this guy.
I'll go ahead, Roy.
I was just going to say, I find Paul, one of the reasons I think Paul is fascinating is that this is a man, you look at him as a kind of case study in religious history. This is a man who has sufficiently convinced of this special insight from God that he has received to begin to base his ministry and his life on that insight.
Yes.
And not simply look to the past as his guide. He acknowledges it. He honors it in his own way, but as opposed to leaning on the tradition about Jesus that his disciples are going to remember, he is willing to move past the tradition on the basis of his own insights. That's extraordinary, and that's a very interesting sort of case study in the way a religion can work.
Yeah, it's like Paul's self-identity had this breakthrough, was very much, I would argue, an identity which is linked to his group understanding, the group that he identified with. Today we would call that a tribal identity. And one of the things that Paul has done...
Pharisaic Jew.
Jew, yes. Right. But this was not an unusual way of identification. In the ancient world, you tended to associate with your primary group, your primary social group.
Look at it today, and that's what we struggle with from the West, with this Eastern...
That's right. We call them dyadic personalities, that you see who you are in other people's eyes, in your primary group's eyes. And what Paul has done is his experience has allowed him to transcend that. So he has become what we've called at times a utopian or a universal thinker, which is something that some people in the ancient world were trying to do. So Paul is really experimenting with what it means to be a human being, not simply a member of a particular group. And he doesn't have the words for that. That's the other thing. If I'm a Jew, and you would ask me, you know, what is today? If a modern person were to say, what does it mean to be a human being? The Jew would say Jew. If I were a Roman, you would say Roman. And that's a code word for a human being. Mm-hmm. So it's the best of your type.
Right.
And Paul is going beyond type.
But may I jump in?
Yeah.
To come at it from maybe a different angle. We get a little argument going here, though I think that's what I want to say is consistent with what Roy and Art have said. I think about it a little differently in that this comes back to now, why did Paul write these letters? I think, in fact, he may have had some exposure to materials about Jesus, to words that he said and stories about him. And then he went off to places like Corinth in the Greco-Roman world and repeated some of that material that he'd learned from in Antioch and so on. And discovered
that had already been started. They weren't his church. There were other groups started by other disciples.
Well, there may well have been, but the evidence, for example, that would be that some of these groups, let's say in Thessaloniki, were probably started by Paul. He was probably the first one there. But be that as it may, he may well have repeated some of the tradition that he learned, and then he leaves for one reason or another. And then he gets reports that, let's say, the Corinthians have completely misunderstood what he said to them. So the reason he writes these personal letters is to try to correct misperceptions. And at that point, some would say he's the first theologian, not in the sense that the letters are theological tractates, but in the sense that he's the first one to reflect on the fact that the sayings of Jesus were also contextual. They were oriented at a particular group of hearers in Galilee, and to lift that material that he might have gotten from the tradition out of the context in which they were uttered and then transport them directly to another context gave rise to misunderstanding. So a part of that experience Roy was talking about, where Paul sees himself as having a new understanding of this material, the way I would put that is he recognizes to say the same thing that Jesus said, let's say, in ancient Palestine, to say that same thing in Corinth or Philippi, he had to say it differently.
Yeah, there's another kind, to me, interesting connection between or similarity between Paul and Jesus. I said a minute ago that Paul did not lean on tradition. He leaned on the insights, his own understanding. Well, you can make the same kind of comment about Jesus.
Mm-hmm,
Jesus was not a scriptural preacher. He didn't ground his teaching or try to authenticate his teaching by quoting scripture. He told stories, we call parables.
Right.
He offered aphorisms, chunky bits of wisdom that people would remember and could unpack at their leisure. So Jesus was operating on the basis of his own understanding of what it meant to be, to live one's life as a member of the kingdom of God, or the empire of God, as we translate it.
And to have a direct connection with God.
In that sense, Jesus is operating in a way that is, in some respects, similar to the way Paul was operating, on the basis of his own insights.
Yeah, and I would add to that, that if you ask, what is the God of Jesus like? And basically, one can say that Jesus trusted that God was, in fact, trustworthy, was reliable. That's Paul's insight about God. So it might not be the case that Paul starts there with Jesus, but his breakthrough and his experience brings him to about the same understanding of God. So there is a very interesting similarity.
That's a very interesting comment. I'll have to chew on that. Incidentally, we were talking offline yesterday at the conference. Lane, you made a claim yesterday that this is the first English translation of Paul we have. I think you worded differently. What did you say?
Well, Ron, you know, this was something of an attention getter in the sense that I was making an outrageous claim in order to get the point out on the table. But the claim I made was that despite all of the English translations we have of the New Testament going back to Tyndale, that the letters of Paul have never been fully translated into English.
And you thought you were reading English when you were reading the letters of Paul.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, well, we're wrong. Now you have the real scoop.
Now the reason,
tell us what you mean.
Yes, thank you, Ron. The reason I made that argument is that previous translations have been based on the idea that you render one Greek word into English with an equivalent English word that you find in a dictionary. And that produces what we would call a literal translation. And
right.
what modern linguistics has done is to argue that literal word-for-word translations are never complete or full or accurate translations, because the meaning that we derive from a piece of communication is determined by units of speech, sentences or paragraphs, if you will, so that individual words change their meaning depending on the context they have within these larger semantic units.
Can you give us an example so we know what you're talking about?
The word Yankee.
Yes.
Yankee originally was a person who comes from New York. He was a Yonker.
Mm-hmm.
Then it becomes a New England merchant. Then it becomes a damn Yankee. Then it becomes a Yank who saves the Europeans. And then, of course, there's the Yankees.
Mm-hmm. The baseball team.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that's one word, but it depending on the context and its situation.
That's right.
Or take a more trivial example. Look at the word made, M-A-D-E. Okay, how would one translate that if you have, let's say, the sentence, the housekeeper made the bed, think of another
no,
example.
Let's stay right there, because just to make it the obvious more clear.
Yeah.
Did she make that bed out of wood?
Does that mean constructed?
That's
did
right.
she construct it, or did she just... Flip the
so so what about the word?
And depending how long she took, it might have been the first word.
Well, what about the use of made in the sentence? You know, the cook made a pie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all sorts of different uses of that word, which depend on the context in which it is used. So that what modern linguists argue is that a literal word-for-word translation is never adequate or even accurate, and they argue that what translation is really about is providing what linguists call a dynamic equivalent of what is said in the original language, in the target language, so that what you're doing is translating not single words, but you're wrestling the meaning of the Greek text to the ground so that you can then turn around and render that equivalent meaning in English, probably in different words.
Well, and remember, I prefaced this whole thing, if I didn't this week, I did last week, saying this is the best translation I've ever read for me, because you have really captured American English and colloquialism. It takes some of these words of Paul, these letters, make no sense, but they do now, after you read this new translation.
Well, that was our aim.
You did a great job.
Well, thank you.
The other scholars might argue with some of the words you translate, but for risk reading it, folks, you've got to get this book. And remember, the name of the book is The Authentic Letters of Paul, Dewey, Hoover, McGahey, and Schmidt. And it's Pulbridge Press. So I'm just giving you another plug, because you're way too modest. And you did an amazing job.
Yes. To repeat what you just said, our aim was to provide a dynamic equivalent translation rather than a literal word-for-word translation.
And are you telling the listeners that the Bible they're reading today, whether it be King James or whether it's paraphrased, they didn't try to do that? You're the first ones?
Yeah, that's the argument. Traditionally the pattern has been that one ought to offer a word for word literal translation. Classicists refer to those kinds of translations as ponies, and so one of the instructions that Bob Funk kept reminding us, or one of his precepts, was that ponies are not translations, and so we're trying to produce a real translation and not just a pony.
Mm-hmm. Got it. And you did a great job. We're approaching the end of the second show already. It does go fast when you're having fun. I wanted to mention one other experience I had, and I'm trying to bring this down to what's important to some people today and how they use Paul or misuse Paul. I had an occasion invited to speak at a Christian men's group in our town where I live. And at this breakfast meeting, they had readings of the gospel. And herein, the pastor read the part that they were going to discuss, and it happened to be 1 Corinthians 34 and 35, wherein Paul admonishes women by saying, quote, "The women are to keep silent in churches, for they are not permitted to speak, but are to subject themselves to their husbands, just as the law also says. If they desire to learn anything, let them ask their own husbands at home, for it is improper for a woman to speak in church." Now, I interjected into that state of affairs that Paul never said these objectionable things, because it doesn't follow with his true trust in women as equals, slaves as equals, Romans as equals, Jews as equals. Of course, that meant they made me pay for my own breakfast, because that's a true story. You call these interpolations into the letters. Help me out, one of you. Tell me about it.
If you read that passage, not just those few verses, but if you read the entire passage, you see that it has nothing to do with women. It has to do with prophecy. And indeed, if you follow the rhetoric and the logic of the argument, you see that these verses actually really go against the flow of the argument.
They disrupt it.
They actually disrupt, that's right.
Right. Paul is creating an argument about whatever it was in that particular thing.
That's right.
There you go. And then all of a sudden, you've got this interjected into the middle of this. So when you pull it out, put the pieces back together, now the story flows again. That's what you're saying.
That's exactly
right. In addition to what Art said, I mean, that, you know, you could observe that in other passages. Mm-hmm. But in fact, this passage in 1 Corinthians 14, 33 through B through 36 is interesting, because that passage, what we call interpolation, is inserted at different points in 1 Corinthians, in the different manuscripts in the early church.
Okay, now stop. I'm sorry. Okay. I know you know it, and I know what you're talking about, but folks, what they're saying is in the early translations, they're reading many different translations in the early Greek, and in that, they find that they stick this little philosophical treatise in a different places.
Various copies of the New Testament were, by hand up until Gutenberg invented the printing press. And so what we have are literally thousands of different copies of various parts of the New Testament. And if you then take various copies of Paul's letters from the earliest stages, what you notice is this passage, 1 Corinthians 14:33b through 36, is inserted after 33a in some of the Greek manuscripts. In other manuscripts, it is inserted after verse 40, at the end of the chapter.
Wow.
In the so-called Latin versions and the Western texts. So when you see a passage that is occurs at different locations and has the kind of seams, that is the disruptions in the flow of the argument that Art and Roy were speaking about, and then you've got pretty solid evidence that this is an interpolation.
I was just going to say, before we get to that, Lane, that in addition to this little piece in chapter 14, where we now see it in our New Testaments, disrupting Paul's argument, and then secondly, being located at different points in Paul's letter in different manuscripts, it's also inconsistent with what Paul says about the status of women in other passages. In chapter 7 of 1 Corinthians, he treats men and women absolutely equal. And in Romans 3, 26 to 28, he says, remember, you are all now one in Christ.
Galatians,
there is no longer
Galatians.
Jew and Greek, slave and free, male and female. You're all one. That is to say, you all have the same standing as members of the new community of the anointed.
Yeah.
So that's Paul's view. And this is different from Paul's.
And folks, I want you to remember, then Romans, the letter to the Romans, very important because Rome was one very important church. And who did he entrust his letter to? And that was Phoebe.
Let me correct my slip of the tongue. It's not Romans 3, 26 to 28. It's Galatians 3, 26 to 28.
That was the whispering going on here.
But Phoebe came with that letter, and he was entrusting her, and perhaps to even stand up in front of the church and read it aloud, because most of these letters were meant to be heard orally.
They were all meant to be performed aloud, usually at the end of the meal. After the dishes were taken away, then they would have the performance, if you will, and the people would hear the performance, and then they would discuss it, and we would even say vote on it.
Now, let's remember, too, that Paul originally dictated these letters.
Yeah.
So they were originally oral.
Yeah.
They were Paul's speech written down by what we would call a secretary and what he called an amanuensis.
And one-third of all the names mentioned in Romans 16 are women.
That's correct.
And including one woman, Junia, who is considered notable among the envoys, among the apostles. So, and she had a sex change in the 16th century. Luther could
no,
not.
That's true. Listen to this, folks.
Luther couldn't believe that a woman could be an apostle, so he turned her name into Junias, which does not occur in the ancient manuscripts or in inscriptions.
I want to just say one quick thing, because people listening to this might say, we have the King James Version, it's the best, it was the first, and we should stick to it. But that's not true, is it?
The King James Version was not the first. I mean, we have to give credit to Tyndale, who actually the King James Version is based upon his translation of the New Testament. One of the things that the King James Version does very well is that it appreciates the rhetoric that we were very concerned about. But we also have to admit that the King James Version is the English of the early 17th century. And it's also the street speech of the 17th century. This is not highfalutin English. This is the kind of English that the people who were in the on the floors at the Shakespeare's Theater would have understood. It becomes highfalutin once you leave its context.
Furthermore, very important complete manuscripts of the New Testament were not discovered and made available to scholars until 200 years or more after the King James was translated. The King James is based on 8th and 9th century manuscripts. Mm-hmm. We now have very high quality manuscripts that go back to the 4th century.
Yeah. That's why we get new translations, Ron.
That's right.
That is, the King James is based on a Byzantine Textus Receptus tradition that's late, as Roy just indicated. Since then, copies of the New Testament have been discovered that are earlier, and so we get new translations based on earlier editions of the New Testament.
Ladies and gentlemen, I know we could go on forever, and we should, but it'll be at a later date. We're running out of time on our second show in a row, so I want to thank you, gentlemen, so very much. Again, I want to mention your book. It's The Authentic Letters of Paul, published by Polebridge Press. You can find it everywhere. It's now in bookstores everywhere and online, so I really recommend it. It is by Arthur Dewey. Thank you, Art.
No problem.
It is by Roy Hoover. Thank you, Roy. And Lane McGahee. Thank you, Lane.
It's been a wonderful project.
It's been a great project. How many years have you been working on this, gentlemen?
Well, about since 1993. And then more specifically, we heated up about what?
2007.
Yeah.
Full time for the last 2.5 years.
Right. 15 or 20 years. This has been this is a work of a lifetime. Most of us don't dedicate ourselves to anything that long. Except our dear wives, of course. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us here again. I hope you enjoyed our little session today. There will be more next week. For now, farewell.